scares people, like not to be able to trust the police officers.
I mean, I've come to London this weekend, you know, these few days to visit, and I was walking around late last night. I probably feel safer here than I do in my own home, if I'm honest, because there's lots of people around, and I, you know, it feels busy and it's well lit.
It did make me quite scared because I lived in London during the pandemic and I heard about that girl getting murdered. So it just makes you think, like, is it good? Is the security here good, you know, in London? And, like, as a girl, do you feel safe walking home at night when you're hearing that? Yeah. So I'd say it just does scare you a bit. Yeah.
Those examples obviously aren't good, but in general, I'd surely say that the police are doing a good job.
I think it scares everybody, really. And I mean, as a tourist myself, I don't really feel so safe walking around here when the police is doing this.
I don't think we should be preaching to internationally to any country, to be honest. We should look closer to home first before we start preaching out, should I say, so to speak. Yeah.
Well, information now travels very, very fast nowadays, and you know, immediately everybody will know in the other countries, so, and everybody talks about it, and for sure it can it does damage to the image of the police here in Great Britain. Absolutely.
I definitely think it'll have a negative effect. You know, it's sort of the first impressions, isn't it? If that's sort of the first you hear about British police or English police, and it's a negative story, then that sets it up for the future. And
I think it projects an image that it's not being correctly managed at the highest levels, and more needs to be done. And I imagine that other nations looking in would wonder, well, if you're allowing that to happen, what else are you allowing to happen too? And therefore breeding greater distrust overall, not only for our own police services, but perhaps breeding mistrust in other aspects of our public services.
I think that it's really sad, and it puts a bad image on the London police.
I think it is a real eye-opener.
It is definitely going to affect, because the people coming from other countries are definitely going to think wrongly.
Whether they break the law themselves, they need to be reprimanded, or whether they're carrying out the law, they need to serve and protect with the utmost integrity and respect for the public as well, because that is their vow and their pledge that they take.
A catalogue of offences uncovered by investigations and confirmed in court has served to keep London's police force in the media for all the wrong reasons. While the UK has previously criticised other countries for their failures in law and order, London's own police force appears a case study in offences admittedly by a small number of individuals, but nevertheless, these cases have undermined the credibility of the force. And some would say it's authority to preach to other countries about enforcement standards.
Revelations and court cases against members of the London Police have damaged confidence in the force. These have also raised questions about the public's level of trust in the police in London. Now, most police do an excellent, honest and difficult job. However, public opinion suggests that trust, which takes a long time to build, can be quickly lost. It is a substantial challenge for the Metropolitan Police to win back what it has lost in terms of that public confidence and, some would say, its international reputation due to the illegal actions of an irresponsible, violent and even murdering few members of the force.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
The limelight.
2 days after the indictment of former White House advisor Steve Bannon, Adam Schiff, a senior Democrat, warned on Sunday, 14th of November, criminal charges are possible for more associates of former U.S. President Donald Trump, who refused to cooperate with the House committee investigating the 6th of January Capitol attack. We prepare for you an article written by Richard Luscombe. The piece is titled, Bannon May Not Be the Only Trump Ally Indicted Over Capitol Attack. Days after the indictment of former White House advisor Steve Bannon, a senior Democrat warned on Sunday, 14th of November, that criminal charges are possible for more associates of former U.S. President Donald Trump, those who refused to cooperate with the House committee investigating the 6th of January Capitol attack. Adam Schiff, the chair of the House Intelligence Committee and a member of the panel investigating the deadly Capitol riot, also said some witnesses could be offered immunity in exchange for testimony in order to advance the inquiry. He told NBC's Meet the Press, he believed without a doubt that the Justice Department decision to charge Steve Bannon with contempt of Congress would shake loose defiant Trump associates. That could include the former Chief of Staff Mark Meadows, who did not show up for a deposition before the House Select Committee on Friday, 12th of November, shortly before Steve Bannon's indictment was announced. Adam Schiff said, now that witnesses see that if they don't cooperate, if they don't fulfill their lawful duty when subpoenaed, that they too may be prosecuted, it will have a very strong focusing effect on their decision-making. He added, even before the Justice Department acted, it influenced other witnesses who were not going to be Steve Bannon. Adam Schiff added, when ultimately witnesses decide, as Mark Meadows has, that they're not even going to bother showing up, that they have that much contempt for the law, then it pretty much forces our hand and will move quickly. Adam Schiff would not be drawn on whether that meant the committee would issue a criminal contempt referral for Mark Meadows, who, unlike Steve Bannon, was a government employee on 6th of January 2021. But he said the panel would decide quickly and that it wanted to make sure we have the strongest possible case to present to the Justice Department and for the Justice Department to present to a grand jury. Mark Meadows' lawyer has said his client will not appear before the committee unless compelled to do so by a judge. Adam Schiff conceded that certain witnesses, whom he did not identify, could receive limited immunity instead of criminal referral in exchange for their cooperation. The decision is to be made on a case-by-case basis. He said, with certain specific witnesses, we ought to consider it. He added, but as that kind of immunity makes it very difficult to prosecute not just them, but sometimes others, we need to think about it very carefully. Adam Schiff said he saw the developments as an early test of whether our democracy was recovering from the turmoil of the Trump administration. He added, basically, the Republican Party at the top levels, that is Donald Trump and those around him, seem to feel that they're above the law and free to thwart the law. And there's something admirable about thumbing your nose at the institutions of our government. Adam Schiff noted, Steve Bannon did what he did because for 4 years that's what worked. They could hold Republican Party conventions on the White House grounds. They could fire inspectors general. They could retaliate against whistleblowers. It was essentially a lawless presidency, and they were proud of it. That ought to concern every American. We need a re-establishment of the rule of law in this country, and I'm glad to see that is happening now. Steve Bannon's indictment and the threat of charges for Mark Meadows marked a significant escalation in the House Committee's efforts to get to the bottom of the 6th of January riot and Donald Trump's attempt to overturn a defeat by Joe Biden. Trump himself is locked in legal battle with the committee over the release of White House documents related to the day of the insurrection, when his supporters ransacked the Capitol building. On Thursday, 11th of November, a federal appeals court in Washington, D.C. handed Donald Trump a temporary victory by blocking the release by the National Archives of hundreds of pages of communication logs, memos, and other materials ordered by a lower court just days before. The appeals court will listen to arguments later this month on Donald Trump's claim that the documents are protected by executive privilege, before making a final decision. Adam Schiff said he believed efforts to delay the inquiry in the courts of law would not succeed. He said, the courts of law themselves have recognized that Donald Trump essentially played our institutions for 4 years and played rope-a-dope in the courts. Adam Schiff added, they moved with such expedition to reject Trump's claims in the district court a week or so ago. Now the Court of Appeals is saying they're going to have a hearing by the end of the month. Courts don't generally move that fast, and I think it's a recognition that Donald Trump has relied on justice delayed, meaning justice denied. So we and the courts of law are moving quickly. Meanwhile, in another development, a senior Senate Republican refused 4 times on Sunday, 14th of November, to condemn Donald Trump for defending supporters who chanted, "Hang Mike Pence," during the deadly assault on the U.S. Capitol on 6th of January. Donald Trump made the comments about his vice president, who did not yield to pressure to overturn Joe Biden's election victory, in an interview with ABC's chief Washington correspondent, Jonathan Carl. John Barroso of Wyoming, the third-ranking Republican in the Senate, appeared on ABC's This Week program. He was asked, can your party tolerate a leader who defends murderous chants against his own vice president? John Barroso of Wyoming replied, well, Let me just say the Republican Party is incredibly united right now, and I think the more that the Democrats and the press become obsessed with President Trump, I think the better it is for the Republican Party. President Trump brings lots of energy to the party. He's an enduring force. He also said the party was focused on elections and policy debate, not the past. His host, George Stephanopoulos, said, "So you have no problem with the president saying, 'Hang Mike Pence' is common sense." John Barroso added, "I was with Mike Pence in the Senate chamber during 6th of January, and what happened was they quickly got Vice President Pence out of there, certainly a lot faster than they removed the senators. I believe he was safe the whole time." John Barroso added, "I didn't hear any of these chants. I don't believe that he did either, and Vice President Pence came back into the chamber that night and certified the election." George Stephanopoulos said, "We just played the chants. I'm asking you if you can tolerate the president saying, 'Hang Mike Pence' is common sense," before pivoting to Trump's lie that the election was subject to widespread voter fraud. John Barroso said, "It's not common sense."
Wildfires in Greece, Turkey, the United States.
Palestinian prisoners in Israeli jails continue to engage in hunger strikes.
Kim Yo-jong, the powerful sister of North Korean leader.
On the news line.
The strategic province of Ma'arib has for some time been a flashpoint of conflict between the Yemeni army and Ansarullah fighters on the one side and the mercenary forces supported by Saudi Arabia and the UAE on the other. Yemeni forces have been inching closer to fully liberating the province. Meanwhile, the leader of Al-Qaeda's branch in Yemen, Khaled Said Batarfi, confessed that the group's terrorists have fought against the Yemeni army and fighters from the popular Ansarullah resistance movement. He said Al-Qaeda terrorists have fought on 11 fronts. Yemen's interior ministry confirmed that the Al-Qaeda terrorists are fighting alongside Saudi-backed militants in Ma'arib, as Yemeni forces are pressing ahead with an offensive to liberate the city. However, Riyadh had denied such cooperation. The Saudi-led alliance had previously claimed it has crushed Al-Qaeda's ability to carry out attacks from Yemen. But in 2018, an investigation by the Associated Press found that the coalition has been paying some Al-Qaeda commanders to leave key cities and towns while letting others retreat with weapons, equipment, and looted cash. According to the report, hundreds of Al-Qaeda members were recruited to join the coalition as soldiers.
The United States and Saudi Arabia created terrorism, beginning with the Mujahideen in Afghanistan, and then moving these people that have been trained by the Central Intelligence Agency and the Saudis, and with the help of Pakistan, to the Balkans, to Yugoslavia, destroying that country. And then again, they were rebranded when they moved into Libya and Iraq and Syria as ISIS or IS or Daesh.
The report also revealed that the United States was aware of the arrangements and prevented drone attacks against the terrorists. Add to it Washington's logistical and weapons support for the Saudi-led coalition. This confirms that the US is on the same side as the Saudi-led coalition and Al-Qaeda terrorists. A CNN investigation in 2019 found that Saudi Arabia and its coalition partners have transferred American-made weapons to Al-Qaeda-linked fighters and other terrorist groups waging war in Yemen. They used the weapons as a currency to buy the terrorists' loyalty. The US itself is also responsible for continually sending deadly weapons to the West Asia region. Washington is also responsible for providing them with heavy weapons. The program was a total failure and only contributed to the growth of the Daesh terrorist group and the humanitarian disaster stretching across Europe. Washington is also responsible for the creation of the Daesh terrorist group. It's also accused of transferring Daesh terrorists from Iraq to Afghanistan before its shambolic withdrawal from the country.
I would certainly think so. I mean, the United States loses weapons. That's beyond belief. I think it's a way of saying, well, we either drop them to the Al-Qaeda people in the peninsula, or we gave them to the Saudis and the Emiratis to pass on to Al-Qaeda in the peninsula. So it's basically hypocrisy, which the Americans are very good at. I think they learned it from the British. But certainly these things don't go missing. They're provided and they're handed over. The Americans are operating in Yemen themselves, although this doesn't seem to make the Washington Post. So it's, yeah, you're right that this is collusion and it's cooperation.
U.S. and its allies have flooded the region with weapons that have ended up in the hands of terrorists. This support for terrorists has fueled a conflict that has killed hundreds of thousands of civilians and children.
Tensions between Russia and the U.S. are on the rise again. On Friday, Moscow said it detected six NATO reconnaissance flights over the Black Sea over the span of 24 hours, reiterating its warning that it will defend itself against any threats along its borders. The Black Sea is a sensitive security zone for Moscow, as it's located near the Crimean Peninsula, which was reunited with Russia from Ukraine in a referendum in 2014, a move that the West deemed illegal.
2014 was a defining moment. Russia stood up for itself like it stood up in 2015 in Damascus across Syria. And this is what's of most concern to Washington in this search for a unipolar world, that Russia would have the audacity, the courage to stand up for itself.
NATO has recently ramped up activities in the form of holding drills and deployment of warships in the strategic region, in a move expected to provoke a response from Russia along its western borders. Kremlin spokesman Dmitry Peskov described on Friday as provocative the increasing NATO's activities in the Black Sea and the presence of Western spy planes in the region.
I mean, Russia doesn't have anywhere close to the amount of U.S. military, the bases that the U.S. has surrounding Russia. Imagine if Russia had bases in Mexico and Canada and in the Pacific. The U.S. would never stand for that. So what we see on full display here is U.S. hypocrisy in the same Russophobic attitude that has characterized U.S. foreign policy for how many decades now.
The Russian Defense Ministry said on Tuesday that the United States was setting up a multinational group of armed forces close to Russia's border in the Black Sea region. The Kremlin has dismissed a Western media report that said the U.S. was concerned about a possible Russian attack on Ukraine, noting that Russia has posed no threats to any country.
And of course, the U.S. acting through NATO with its junior allies, constantly building up troops in Latvia, in Estonia, in Poland, across Russia's borders. So it's the Russians that have every right to be concerned.
In the meantime, the migrant crisis at the border between Belarus and Poland is also spiraling into another regional dispute involving the West at Russia's doorsteps. Thousands of migrants have been stranded along the border for months after being denied entry to the European Union by Poland. Minsk says Warsaw is violating international asylum norms by preventing the migrants from crossing the border and greeting them with a heavy-handed response. In face of escalating military activities near the border, Belarus and Russia held snap joint military drills in the area. Russia's defense ministry confirmed in a statement that its paratroopers were taking part in the exercise. Minsk has also threatened to cut off Russian gas supplies to Europe through pipelines that transit through Belarusian territory in retaliation for any possible sanctions from the EU. It would be bad news for Europe if Belarus moves to carry out the threat, as gas prices on the continent have already hit all-time highs and are vulnerable to any possible supply disruptions.
The United States has decided to bolster its military ties to NATO ally Greece. The military agreement was concluded during the recent visit of the Greek Minister of Foreign Affairs, Nikos Dendias, to Washington. The new agreement will remain in force indefinitely unless one of the parties withdraws. The military agreement will make Greece the U.S. military logistics center in the region.
Greece has been in America's orbit and has enjoyed a strategic partnership with America ever since the end of the Greek Civil War, in which the Greek nationalists triumphed over the Greek communists as a result of the military assistance which America provided to them.
The U.S. will also have increased military presence in the Alexandroupolis, Crete, the Tochoro, and Larissa regions. The renewed agreement gives the U.S. the right to access any Greek military bases and to expand the areas for the U.S. forces to conduct military drills. The U.S. Navy will also be able to go to Bulgaria and Romania without using Turkey's straits. The agreement will significantly reduce the importance of Turkey regarding Black Sea access. Greece has been trying to position itself strategically in the region.
The Americans are encountering some problems with Erdogan. So by America and Greece concluding this extraordinary military deal, it is a way of the Americans placing subtle pressure on Erdogan, not on the Turkish state, but on Erdogan personally.
In recent months, the U.S. has sent heavy military equipment to the Balkans and European countries through the port of Alexandroupolis, with plans for further military shipments in November. Back in November 2020, Greece submitted a request to the U.S. Department of Defense to purchase F-35 fighter jets. The proposal was welcomed by the U.S. In other words, it would not be surprising if the F-35s, which were not given to Turkey, were given to the neighboring countries soon. The military cooperation between the U.S. and Greece comes amid a row between Ankara and Athens. Greece and Turkey are both NATO members, but they are at loggerheads over a number of issues. Back in 2020, Turkey dispatched Oryx Reis and warships escorting it to survey an area between Cyprus and the Greek island of Crete in the eastern Mediterranean Sea. The mission was meant to explore oil and natural gas in that region. That led to an escalation of tensions, with the two NATO allies launching air and naval drills of their own in the waters.
The major reason behind this agreement, this military agreement between Washington and Athens, is a result of America having gathered some of its allies from the Mediterranean, North Africa, and the Middle East in an Eastern Mediterranean partnership. Now, what am I referring to? Well, I'm referring to the reserves of oil and gas which have been found adjacent to Cyprus.
Greece has also accused Turkey of acting like a pirate state in the Aegean Sea in regards to migrants. Athens has called on the EU to put pressure on Ankara to meet its international obligations. Athens frequently blames Ankara for failing to crack down on smugglers who send out migrants in unsafe boats from its shores in breach of a 2016 accord with the European Union. Under the accord, Turkey was to reduce the flow of migrants through its territory to EU countries such as Greece, return for billions in financial aid.
Well, of course, Turkey is a dangerously expansionist country. After all, Turkey illegally occupies the north of Cyprus. Turkey illegally occupies the northwest of Syria. However, there is very little chance of a conflict between Turkey and Greece. Why? Because both countries are in NATO and both countries enjoy a strategic partnership with America.
It is believed Turkey's President Recep Tayyip Erdogan is using the migrant issue to put more pressure on the European Union. The military cooperation between Greece and the U.S. would give Athens a greater leverage in its confrontation with Turkey. The Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan has not made it a secret in the aspirations that it has to have influence in the entire West Asia region and beyond.
World temperatures are rising fast, and that is mostly because humans are using fossil fuels like oil, gas, and coal for their transportation, industries, and homes. The use of these fuels releases a great amount of greenhouse gases, mostly carbon dioxide, which trap the sun's heat and make the earth warmer. That is global warming. This phenomenon is leading to long-term shifts in temperatures and weather patterns, which is known as climate change. The dangerous trend is causing extreme weather conditions. The impact is being felt in many parts of the world, but the worst could be yet to come. Combating climate change requires concrete measures by the international community, especially the world's largest polluters like the United States and China. But scientists have repeatedly warned that global efforts to tackle climate change are way off track. Global warming and climate change have been under the spotlight in the Scottish city of Glasgow over the past 2 weeks as delegations from around the world attended the UN Climate Change Conference. Participants tried hard to find a way forward to contain what many scientists have called the biggest crisis of humanity. The world's largest industrial nations long struggled to find common ground, but an unexpected declaration by the United States and China this week raised hopes for a breakthrough.
Certain elements that will promote ambition.
The United States and China have pledged to work together to achieve the 1.5 degrees Celsius temperature goal set out in 2015. China's climate envoys, as the two sides hammered out the declaration following some 30 meetings over the past year. U.S. President Joe Biden and his Chinese counterpart Xi Jinping are expected to hold a follow-up meeting soon. The announcement was welcomed by the United Nations and the European Union. But global campaigning network Greenpeace says both countries need to take concrete action. Some experts have noted that this week's declaration was short on commitments that would significantly reduce the emissions of harmful gases like CO2.
Everyone is being very careful not to say anything definitive. There are a few dates, few specific levels things we'll get to, and few amounts of money that will go to developing countries. So there's pretty much nothing that doesn't need to be more specific. You know, we're all good guys and we're going to cooperate and make this work. Well, we've heard that before.
Scientists warn that the world faces a race against time. Climate Action Tracker Group has calculated that the world is facing 2.4 degrees of warming by the end of the 21st century. If the world fails to act, scientists estimate that it could even exceed 4 degrees in the future. That will probably lead to destructive heat waves, with many millions of people around the world losing their homes as sea levels rise. Temperature rises must be contained quickly if the international community is determined to avoid the worst consequences of climate change. That means global warming needs to be kept at 1.5 degrees Celsius in the coming decades. That seems like a far-fetched wish, given the record of the worst polluters.
I'm not feeling overly optimistic. I'm not really feeling optimistic at all, because it seems like this is just more grandstanding by the particularly China and the United States and even the European Union, who have gotten things, the developing countries have gotten things to this point.
All eyes are now on the world's largest emitters to see how they will act.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
ایمان را در خودتون تقویت بکنید، ایمانی که هم در اینجا شما را شرافتمند می کند و هم در پیشگاه حق آبرو دارید و با آبرومندی وارد می شید به تخت اعلی.
In the path of the Imam.
Dear listeners, as a reminder, we talked about Imam Khomeini's recommendations to the seminaries and religious scholars of ulama, which were issued in his faithful message and also in his testament. In today's program, we're going to touch upon Imam's advice to the executive branch of the government, especially the foreign ministry and Iranian diplomats. Stay with us for more. Imam Khomeini, may God bless his soul, used to stress that if the executive branch of the government is not reformed, no remarkable result would be gained for the nation, even if there were good laws. He wrote in his testament, "Among the affairs that need to be reformed, purified, and cared for is the executive branch of the government. Sometimes progressive and useful laws may be passed in the parliament, and the Guardian Council may approve it, and a relevant minister may proclaim it, but it may go to unrighteous executors so that they would annul it, and contrary to the rules or with the bureaucracies and twisting that they have got used to or intentionally, they act in a way to make people worried, to gradually cause a row." Imam Khomeini considered honest bond with people and rendering services to them, especially to the less well-off and deprived classes, as an undeniable necessity of the Islamic Republic. He used to emphasize that neglecting the principle is religiously forbidden and would incur divine wrath. The Imam wrote, "The budget from which you and the employees of the ministries are paid from belongs to the nation. You should be the servants of the nation, especially the oppressed. And you should know that causing trouble for people and acting opposite to their duty is haram or religiously forbidden, and God forbid would sometimes incur divine wrath. All of you need the nation's support. It was with the people's support, particularly the less well-off and the deprived classes, that victory was achieved, and the hand of the oppressive kingdom was cut off from the country and its reserves. And if one day you are deprived of their support, you will be put aside, and like the oppressive royal regime, oppressors would occupy the posts instead of you. In view of this tangible reality, you must try to draw the people's attention and refrain from un-Islamic and inhumane behavior." Thank you. Khomeini, may God bless his soul, said in a famous speech to cabinet ministers and the government, he said, "Serve this nation which has cut off the treacherous hands and has put its trust in you. As long as you are such, the nation will back you, and as long as the nation accompanies you, no harm will occur to you and the country." The Imam writes to the foreign ministry and diplomats, "I recommend the foreign minister in this era and the next era to be heedful that your responsibility is very much either in the reformation and development of the ministry and embassies or the foreign ministry, safeguarding the independence of this country and the interests of this country, and good relations with governments which don't intend to meddle in our country's affairs. And seriously refrain from anything that is suspicious of dependence with all of its dimensions. And know that dependence in some affairs, although it may have a deceptive appearance or interest and use for the time being, however, it would draw the country to destruction." Imam Khomeini believed that an important step towards independence of the foreign ministry is to reinforce bonds with Islamic countries, and asked the diplomatic missions to embark on awakening the Islamic countries and inviting Muslim nations to unity and solidarity. The Imam wrote, "I recommend to the nations of Islamic countries not to expect anyone from abroad to help you in reaching the goal which is Islam and executing Islamic laws and rules. You yourselves should rise up for this vital affair, which will materialize freedom and independence." And the great religious scholars and respectful preachers of Islamic countries should invite governments to get rid of dependence on big foreign powers and to rely on their own abilities. In this way, they will embrace victory. And they should invite nations to unity and refrain from racism, which is opposite to the rule of Islam, and shake hands of brotherhood with their brethren in faith in any country and with any race, as the great Islam has called on them as brothers. And if one day this brotherhood in faith materializes with the efforts of governments and nations and the help of Almighty God, you will see that Muslims will form the greatest power on earth. Imam Khomeini also warns staff of the foreign ministry by saying, "Since the victory of the Islamic Revolution, I have issued recommendations to foreign ministers about development of embassies, which should be compatible with Islamic Republic. Yet, some of them either didn't want to or failed to take any positive action."
Of Jalali, Tehran.
Rubashavit, Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Saeed Pereza, London.
Rashan Saglam, Istanbul.
Saeed Aminolemi, Kabul.
Shahanabad, Indian administered Kashmir.
Round the world with reporters.
In an interview released by Al-Qaeda's media, the leader of Al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula, Khaled Batarfi, admitted that the terrorists have been fighting forces of Yemen's Ansarullah movement on 11 fronts. Batarfi said the role in fighting the Houthi fighters is clear and no one can deny it. This raises a fresh speculation about the cooperation between the Saudi-led forces and the Al-Qaeda terrorists, previously reported by media, including the 2016 battle for Taiz. زعيم تنظيم القاعدة.
القاعدة leader's confession of their participation in the battles against the Yemeni army confirms our earlier remarks that there is a strategy taken by the Saudi-led coalition using terrorists to support its mercenaries, and this confession may be through which the Al-Qaeda leader is trying to prove their presence and that they have a role in a battle that has been going on for years. We will continue to liberate all Yemeni lands from terrorist organizations, whether in Marib or elsewhere.
Experts say the U.S. has been using and supporting terrorist groups in Yemen since the beginning of the Saudi-led war, just as it has supported the Saudi war on Yemen. They say the Yemeni army has proven this by seizing caches of weapons bearing USAID logos in Al-Qaeda arms depots.
The U.S. is the main supporter of Al-Qaeda, Daesh, and all terrorist organizations, and it seeks to control the countries in which the terrorists are present. When it comes to Yemen, Al-Qaeda failed in this, and the Yemeni army managed to expel the terrorists from their main stronghold in Al-Baida Governorate. The Yemeni army found tons of U.S.-made weapons in Al-Qaeda's warehouses in Al-Baida, and this is another proof that the United States is the main supporter of terrorist organizations.
Earlier this year, Yemen's Interior Ministry also said Al-Qaeda terrorists are fighting alongside Saudi-backed forces in Yemen's Marib province, where the Yemeni army is pressing ahead with a liberation offensive, which Riyadh denied. The statement by the Al-Qaeda leader shines a new light on how the Saudi-led war has helped prop up terrorist groups in Yemen with the help of the U.S. Yemenis, however, believe that their army will eventually liberate the entire territory of their country from terrorist groups and occupiers. Abdul Latif Al-Washal, Sana'a.
The Palestinian Authority is experiencing the worst fiscal difficulties it has ever had since its establishment more than a quarter century ago. PA officials say this could soon reflect on its ability to pay its employees' salaries and conduct daily business. The European Union is the PA's largest single donor, but the bloc has not donated any aid to the authority so far in 2021. Palestinian Prime Minister Mohamed Ishtayi has meanwhile told his cabinet several days ago that the PA hasn't either received any financial aid from the Arab countries for 2 years.
There's no doubt that the PA is going through a real and suffocating financial crisis. Its manifestations are evident. There's a budget deficit, an accumulation of debt, and delays in paying its obligations, the salaries, paying for the education, infrastructure, health, and all sections. It's undeniable that there is a clear decline in aid.
Along with the long-standing fiscal leakages that are contributing to the financial crisis, Israel continues to deduct millions of U.S. dollars every month from clearance revenue transfers. This is in response to the payments by the Palestinian Authority to the prisoners held in Israeli jails, their families, and the families of those killed by Israeli forces.
Taxes collected by Israel on behalf of the PA, including customs duties, constitute a major source of revenue for the Palestinian economy. Israel often uses the fund transfers as a bargaining chip in its volatile relationship with the PA. They do not want for the PA to have any strength. They want to use the money it deducts to keep control in a way or another on the PA.
Meanwhile, the World Bank called on donors to help reduce the budget deficit, saying that the financial situation remains fragile due to high public spending and very low external financing to the PA.
At the end of the day, observers have expressed concern that the increasingly cash-strapped PA could face financial collapse. PA officials say the main reason behind the financial crisis is the lack of international and Arab donations to the Palestinians. Mona Qandil, Occupy Jamallah.
Vienna's International Book Fair, cancelled like many other events in 2020, has come back to life this year. With only vaccinated or recovered people allowed into the exhibition hall, visitors can move freely without face masks. More than 300 publishers from over 30 countries used the opportunity to showcase their new releases. One of them was Iran.
We are also pleased to have another event for Iran's
representation of Iranian culture, Iranian science and technology in the format of the excellent and eloquent books that have been produced by Iranian scholars and gifted philosophers.
Books here are mainly bilingual, an opportunity for cultural exchange.
This year, I'm very happy because one of my poetry books, which was published in Iran, is on display here. Of course, Iran is the center of poetry, and Iranian culture is deeply intertwined with poetry. I really wanted to publish my poems in Persian, since my previous work, published here in Austria, was only in German.
For many, visiting the Iran stand was a trip down memory lane.
Mashhad.
I traveled from Tehran to Mashhad by train and then visited other cities by bus. I met a lot of different people, not just Iranians, but also tourists from other countries. As foreigners, we were impressed with the Iranian people's warm response and their positive attitude. It was a very interesting, unforgettable, and beautiful trip. I hope I can visit Iran again.
Vienna's Book Fair is the center of a week-long national reading festival involving hundreds of authors in dozens of venues.
Although many feared the book industry would not be able to weather the storm of the pandemic, hopes have actually risen for the industry, with people reading more in lockdown, some even discovering for the first time the unique kind of pleasure that reading provides. Homa Lezgi, Vienna.
On Sunday, the Afghan capital Kabul hosted a webinar titled Muslim World Ulamas and the Recent Developments in Afghanistan. Top clerics from seven Islamic countries, namely Afghanistan, India, Pakistan, Iran, Palestine, Iraq, and Croatia, participated in the event. They said the U.S. withdrawal from Afghanistan opened a new chapter in the country, adding that it's up to the new rulers to form an inclusive government and maintain stability.
Afghans are proud people. They succeeded to defeat the U.S. and its allies and free their country. We hope the new administration learns from the past and understands that no one can rule over Afghanistan with dictatorship and oppression. I think Afghanistan must have a popular and inclusive government in order to prevent disputes.
We welcome the recent developments in our country, as it is meant to cease hostilities and violence on our soil. We are happy that our people don't hear the news of war every day, or at least hear lesser than they did during the invasion. But the fact is that recent terrorist attacks show that we are still far from permanent security and peace.
The attendees also stressed the need for Islamic solidarity and urged the Taliban and Afghans to stay awake and knowledgeable to foil enemies' scheme.
My advice to the Afghan people is that they should launch an educational movement and everyone should be illiterate so that they can detect enemies' plots. In addition, there should be a solidarity between Muslim brothers because their enemies are trying to sow sedition between Shias and Sunnis, especially by carrying out deadly attacks.
Addressing the conference, the clerics also urged Islamic countries to help Afghans amid difficulties and economic hardship. The participants of the webinar stressed unity among all Muslims, especially in Afghanistan. This as the Taliban government is yet to be recognized by world countries and people are facing looming crisis. Rahmatullah Baghban, Kabul.
A two-day photographic and film exhibition on the annual pilgrimage of Arba'in began in the Italian capital on Saturday. Arba'in marks the 40th day of the martyrdom anniversary of Imam Hussein, the third Imam of Shia Muslims. It is commemorated annually through a march being the biggest in the world and known as Arba'in Pilgrimage from different countries to Kabbala and holding ceremonies in the Iraqi city. The photo exhibition, organized by the Imam Mehdi Islamic Association and the NGO Arba'in Travelogue, showcases a selection of photos from the world's largest gathering in late September this year. The main focus of the initiative is global justice.
We do our best to bring the message of Arba'in to Europe, to every country, to every city, to every one of those people, and say the truth that Arba'in is follow the global peace, global justice. And global justice, global peace, global empathy is what we're missing now.
There is an amazing atmosphere in Kabbalah. Iraqi people welcomed us the best way they could. The first time I went there, Saddam Hussein had just been removed. I traveled all the way from Iran to the Holy Shrine. It was an unforgettable experience.
Despite the COVID-19 pandemic, hundreds of thousands of Shia Muslim pilgrims converged on Kabbalah in late September to commemorate the end of the 40-day mourning period for the death of Imam Hussein.
People at the photo exhibition say Al-Bayin should be seen as a model for our societies, one in which each and every one of us has a role, irrespective of our nationality, financial status, and ethnic or religious background.
I think it would be really nice to take it as a model because you see that everything is there organized by people who are doing their best without any rules, without any fines, without any pushing from the outside. So it can be implemented to our daily life, and hopefully I would say that the people could be inspired by it and try to have it in their daily life as much as possible.
Ciò che avviene durante la marcia del 40esimo.
What happens during the Arba'in can inspire our societies. Generosity, sacrifice, selflessness, these are values that better our societies, and that's what we should all aim at.
Some 14 million worshippers attended the Arba'in in 2019. Max Civili, Rome.
Ten innocent family members were killed by a U.S. drone strike on a home in Kabul. After the attack, the Pentagon apologized for the mistake and said the U.S. is considering making payments to the family of the victims and will get them out of Afghanistan. But it seems Washington has been indifferent to these promises as the family still awaits justice.
The attack was very horrific to our family. It martyred 10 of our loved ones and shocked those who have survived. When our relatives come here, it hurts them as they remember those innocent children martyred here. Of course, the U.S. should be held accountable.
Justice should be done to us. They promised that those responsible would be tried in a court, compensation would be paid, and they would take us out of Afghanistan. After their announcement, they have done nothing. They must stay true to their commitments.
Afghans and U.S. war survivors have repeatedly asked for meaningful transparency and accountability for the U.S. killings of their loved ones, but they have not received it from Washington so far.
The U.S. has always lied to these people. They make promises but don't fulfill them. For instance, see Ajmal's family that were decimated by the U.S. All of those killed were innocent. It has been 3 months that their relatives are left helpless.
People also believe that during its invasion of Afghanistan, the U.S. military has always killed civilians, lied about it, and finally exonerated themselves. More than 2 months after this tragic attack, the U.S. has not taken any practical steps to reach out to the victims' family or pay compensation to them. And the survivors are still awaiting justice. Rahmatullah Baghban, Kabul.
Pervasive challenges remain for migrants and asylum seekers no matter Europe, the United States, or Asia. The recent immigrant crisis on the Belarusian border with Poland has refreshed the plight refugees have endured at the hands of some governments. Thousands of asylum seekers are currently stranded in desperate conditions on the Belarusian border, with thousands of Polish soldiers, guards, and police on the other side blocking their entry. Ironically, the European Union has backed Poland's move in line with the bloc's resolve that it will go to any length to prevent migrants from reaching its external borders. This means turning a blind eye to even gross human rights abuses against refugees. Instead of searching for a mechanism to resolve the crisis, the EU has rather opened a diplomatic war with Belarus and Russia by directly pointing its finger at the two for the current problem. The 27-member bloc is not an exception. Just recently, the United States violently encountered with mostly Haitian immigrants near its borders. Hundreds were deported and thousands were sent to detention centers. It seems the Biden administration has continued the footsteps of its